Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. I'll be keeping you company here on News Talk for the next hour as we look at some of the big stories making the news here in Ireland and all around the world. Coming up on today's show, the warning signs flashing red for the global economy, what's ahead and how might it affect us all. We'll be speaking to Tom Stanage, who's the deputy editor of The Economist magazine, to get his analysis on it all. And have you ever wondered about the most expensive homes changing hands in Ireland, from a sprawling Cork estate to the childhood home of Garrett Fitzgerald? 2024 has seen over 1,000 sales topping €1 million. Alana Gallagher from the Irish Times will be joining us later for a tour of these prestigious properties. And finally, could the mega app TikTok be banned in the US? Chris Stokel Walker will be here to tell us the latest and explain what implications it could have for other providers and for all of you who are addicted to the app. Stay tuned for all of that. You can get in touch with us on takingstock@newstalk.com or we're on Twitter at StockNT.
Techscape on Taking Stock. Brought to you by PwC. Our industry experts can help you unlock the full potential of AI to transform your business safely and responsibly. Visit pwc.ie to learn more.
So first up today, the future of one of the world's most popular social media platforms is hanging in the balance. With over 1 billion monthly active users, TikTok has established itself as a social media giant. But recent legislation signed by the United States President Joe Biden could see the app banned from distribution in the US unless the Chinese parent company ByteDance sells it by January 2025. Well, what does this all mean for TikTok, you, its users, and the content creators who make a very valuable living from it? Well, joining me now to unpack all of this is Chris Stokel Walker, technology journalist. Chris, welcome back to Taking Stock.
Thanks for having me, Mandy.
Now, maybe you'd be better explaining to us exactly what the US are trying to do about TikTok first, and we'll get into the why later.
It's essentially an attempt, I suppose, cynically thinking, to force TikTok into a fire sale. So one of the things that we kind of have to use as context here, I suppose, is the long history of social media. So to dash through 20 odd years of history in about 10 seconds, we have lived through a social media era which is seen through a lens of Silicon Valley in the United States. And we know that for good and for evil, there are benefits and drawbacks to that. But basically every single app, every single service that we use in our digital lives through social media has its genesis in Silicon Valley. TikTok was not that. TikTok was slightly different. Founded in the mid to late 2010s in China by a company called ByteDance, originally as a kind of Chinese-based only app, and also with a kind of an app that it bought called Musical.ly, and then subsumed into its own app that then launched in the West as TikTok became hugely popular. And I think that sits really uneasily with some people. Now, the US, in particular Joe Biden's administration, is particularly concerned around that China link. They worry that there is a national security risk there. Worth pointing out, there is no actual evidence that TikTok has ever meddled in, for instance, US conversations around social discussion issues or politics or anything like that. But just the fact that this has a ultimately Chinese ownership sits deeply uncomfortably with certain people within the Biden administration and also a good number of China hawks in the Republican Party. And so we've come to this over many months and frankly almost a year now, this kind of wrangling around the future of TikTok, which has resulted in this divest or sell up or be banned ultimatum from a court.
And you and I, Chris, have spoken in the past on this program about various different governments around the world actually, and their attitude to TikTok and banning ministers and politicians from even having accounts. I mean, this is the more extreme element of it. But what are the US government trying to do? So they're trying to get the company ByteDance to sell to whom, or what? How would that manifest itself?
Basically, anybody who is American enough to feel comfortably and safe under their control, Mandy, is the, the long and the short of it. So there are kind of potential suitors. We have had in the past discussions where Oracle, which is a database company, which also provides some of the database services for TikTok as part of an agreement with the US government over concerns in a previous year around this sort of stuff. They're currently providing that. And they could be a potential buyer. Many others could be, but there's really nobody that is waiting in the wings to buy TikTok. And also, TikTok doesn't want to sell. ByteDance doesn't want to divest itself of this company because ultimately, you know, worldwide, this has 1.5 billion users, more than 150 million in the European Union, in the United States, where this has the threat of being banned. They have more than 170 million users. And so, frankly, TikTok would be giving up an awful lot of money if they were to decide to kind of sell themselves out of existence.
So I'm interested in the mechanics of this. So the US government had to file or introduce and pass legislation that would ban the platform if it wasn't sold. And then the company, as I understand it, then they filed an injunction or an appeal against that. Where is all that at now?
Yeah, so we had in early December, December the 6th, a three-judge panel sitting in Washington that upheld that idea that ByteDance, the parent company of TikTok, would have to sell up to an American owner or stop operating in the US over those national security concerns. Now, 3 days later, December the 9th, TikTok filed an emergency injunction asking for essentially a stay of execution. They wanted this case to be heard by the Supreme Court in the US, and that is essentially TikTok's last roll of the dice. Mm. If the US Supreme Court says, no, you know what, we uphold previous court judgments on this, and they don't rely on what TikTok believes is an oddly American attempt to defend on this sort of thing, actually, Mandy, which is the right of freedom of speech, the ability to say what you want as a company in the US, then it will essentially be incumbent on, for instance, app stores, so your Apple's App Store, Google's Play Store, to stop updating the app, to stop offering it, more importantly, to new users. And so we end up with this kind of very odd moment where I suppose TikTok will be crystallized in amber. I think you might still be able to upload content to it, but it just means that no new users will be able to actually download it and log on.
And just say it is banned in the US and we get to the 19th of January and they ByteDance don't sell and they ban the platform and those operators like Google and iPhone and all those, they can no longer bring new people on board and the updates don't happen, I guess, for, you know, existing users or whatever. It kind of peters out. What do you think that will mean for other governments around the world who can take a lead very often from what happens in the US?
Yeah, it is, I suppose, the multi-billion dollar question because, you know, TikTok is a huge business in the US, but it has lots of other markets around the world and there will be people watching this. I think it is notable that we haven't seen other countries following in the footsteps of the US as they pursue this through the courts already. And so I think that that maybe signals that other countries aren't quite as uncomfortable with TikTok as the US currently is. And so I imagine that we won't see, for instance, lots of dominoes starting to fall around the world as others row in behind the US. And one of the big interesting things around this is the timing, and it's almost a repeat of 4 years ago, Mandy, when Donald Trump said that he was going to ban TikTok from the US as part of his unsuccessful attempt to get reelected in 2020. Turns out that what happened was TikTok fought that through the court, kicked the can down the road until Trump lost the presidential election in 2020, therefore wasn't inaugurated in 2021. And Joe Biden came in with a clean broom. Now, TikTok will be hoping for the same sort of thing. January the 19th is when this app could be snuffed out in the United States. January the 20th, Donald Trump takes power in the White House. And Donald Trump has had a complete change of heart on TikTok. He now thinks that actually it should remain. And so while with Donald Trump, you never really know what he's going to do or what he's thinking at any one moment in time, there is a potential scenario in the month to come where TikTok is banned for pretty much one day, and then Trump comes into the White House and overturns it entirely.
And do you think his new kind of alliance with his now best buddy Elon Musk might change his view again, maybe? Because I'm presuming other platforms like X, Instagram, YouTube, they'll all see themselves as maybe developing alternatives to TikTok were it banned in the US.
This is where it gets incredibly messy, Mandy. And this is where Elon Musk and politics really should not mix. And I think where we might start to see Trump's cozying up to Musk starting to unravel a little bit. So in theory, yes, Elon Musk, big entrepreneur, always looking for the next opportunity, might decide that he wants to take X, the platform formerly known as Twitter, down a sort of TikTok-alike short-form video route. But having said that, Elon Musk is also the CEO of Tesla. Hmm. Tesla is a big electric car company that has significant interests, including manufacturing plants for its electric vehicles in China, and sees that as a big market. So you start to get this really awkward situation where the geopolitics and the business interests rub up against one another in a way that we often find, I think, probably deeply uncomfortable, unless we are Elon Musk. And I think so for that reason, I don't imagine that Musk will change Donald Trump's mind. But I will say we are seeing, for instance, Mark Zuckerberg announced this week, the CEO of Meta, which runs Instagram, which has its own TikTok alike called Reels. He will be donating to Trump's inauguration fund to try and, you know, fund his big party, his big bash that he has on January the 20th. We've seen him already trying to ingratiate himself with meetings at Mar-a-Lago with Donald Trump. So there is the potential here that whispers in the ear could happen to try and say, well, you know what? I know that you had this different view on TikTok, but actually, is it worth the geopolitical hassle? Is it worth the potential annoyance of your general public? Although I will say that actually public support for a TikTok ban has cratered in the last year. In spring of 2023, around about 50% of Americans said that they thought a ban on TikTok was necessary and important. Nowadays, that's around about only a third. So I think people are starting to reckon with what the consequences of this really could be for their lives.
Mm. That's very interesting. And has that shift happened because more people have been using it and they're comfortable with it? They're kind of addicted to it now, probably.
Yeah, I think it's a couple of things. I think one is just that use and that kind of you start to stare the future into the mirror and look really deeply into the whites of your own eyes and think, actually, do I want this to happen or do I not? And what are the consequences? But I think that there is also a more cynical, less kind of self-reflective point of view here, which is TikTok is a massive company.
Mm.
ByteDance, its parent company, has a fair bit of cash sloshing around, and they have spent an awful lot of money on public interest campaigns, on lobbying to try and ensure that their existential threat is perhaps not all that existential in the near future. So I think it's a vindication of all of that effort and that time and that money that's been put in. But you're right. I think there is a kind of a reckoning with the consequences here. And we do have precedent for this. 4 years ago, India banned TikTok from its country because of something relatively similar, a geopolitical dispute that didn't really seem to have a strong connection or justification with the app itself. Essentially, there was a border dispute between India and China at the time. India decided that the best way to try and hit China was through the sort of sanctions pocket, so it banned TikTok. We saw at the time a lot of homegrown apps rise up to try and replace TikTok, but actually the ones that stuck were the big tech giants of YouTube Shorts, owned by Google, and Instagram Reels, owned by Meta, the parent company of Facebook and WhatsApp, as well as Instagram. But all of those are not exactly like TikTok, and they are, I suppose, a little bit of a pale imitation of the real app itself.
It does raise a very interesting question, really, about this as a precedent, perhaps, for how the US in the future might handle foreign-owned digital platforms. But that's another day's work. I want to ask you about something you raised there about the who uses the app itself, because we tend to think of it as users and, you know, enjoy the app. And as you say, that's grown. But the other side of it is, a lot of politicians and many, many businesses worldwide have got used to, you know, being able to talk directly to customers or potential voters as a direct mechanism for doing that. What are they doing to prepare for this, or how are they treating this potential ban?
They're worrying, in short. And I think that this is perhaps TikTok's best bet to try and get Trump on side. We know the man is a businessman. We know that he thinks largely in terms of business interests. You can't necessarily appeal to emotions with him, but you can appeal to bottom lines and balance sheets. And so TikTok has taken that approach. When it lodged its injunction against the court decision earlier this month, it did so with a press release that looked at this in terms of cold, hard cash. It said, if you ban our app on January the 19th, within the first month, the individual creators on that app based in the United States will lose an estimated $300 million of income through the app. If you ban our app on January the 19th, in the next month, the businesses that market their wares through the app will lose more than $1 billion of revenue in the same time period. And so Donald Trump is all about making America great again. He's all about prioritizing American-based businesses. And he might well look at that and go, well, do I want to be responsible for the losses of those individuals, for the losses of those businesses? Might well cause him to change his mind.
Absolutely. It's extraordinary how an app has such economic and geopolitical consequences. And it's quite unbelievable, isn't it, that we could be talking about something that some people who use it, including myself, tend to pick it up and think it's a trivial thing, but actually it's a massive giant of geopolitical sort of warfare now. Chris, before I let you go, just very briefly, if you could just tell me what you think is going to happen at the end of January.
I think that this was going to be kicked down the road once more. I think there'll be a Supreme Court appeal. I think that will delay things. They'll appeal significantly to Donald Trump. And then actually, who knows what Donald Trump will do, but I would say probably TikTok will stick around.
Absolutely. Well, Chris, listen, thank you as always for explaining that to us. It's a very complicated situation that stems back years. That was Chris Stokel-Walker, technology journalist. Thank you so much for being with us on Taking Stock.
Thank you.
You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. Next, over 1,000 sales of over €1 million or more have been recorded so far this year. With a Cork estate leading the charge, Alana Gallagher of the Irish Times will be here to take us through the hallowed halls. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, housing has been arguably the most important part of the recent general election campaign, discussing everything from supply, rental availability and all the housing targets that you can think of from all of the different political parties. But today we thought we'd take the opportunity to look at the other end of the spectrum. The people have absolutely no problem getting or paying for properties. It's the super prime market. We'll all know of this market from Netflix documentaries that not only look at the houses themselves, but look behind how the houses are sold and the teams who are selling them. In Ireland last year, over 1,000 homes were sold in excess of €1 million. But some of those were for multiple figures of that. So things that we could only ever dream about. Alana Gallagher and her colleague Jessica Doyle from the Irish Times have been looking what's happening in that particular market in Ireland, and Alana joins me on the line now. Alana, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Thanks, Mandy. How are you?
That backdrop of housing, you know, I mean, we tend to always have that conversation about, you know, one side of supply and everything. But let's just look at the super prime market here in Ireland. How has that been faring in 2024?
Well, the funny thing about the super prime market is that in many ways, it's exactly like the rest of the market in that, you know, they have needs and, well, sorry, let me reframe that. They have the same needs and wants as the rest of us do in our house hunting. And believe it or not, even with the staggeringly huge figures that are covered here, according to the property price register, you know, they still have difficulty finding stock, believe it or not, Mandy. But it is a very rarefied air. We are mindful that, you know, we are coming into, you know, at Christmas time, you know, as you mentioned in your intro, I mean, the figures are staggering for those that are homeless. For anyone trying to buy, I've just been lucky enough you know, in that position, but then again, trying to find a builder. And that dovetails back into this as well. But it is a very specialized market and a very small market. You know, like I just did a really quick look today online on my home, and you know, there's like 20 houses at the 2 million, the 3 million and at the 4 million price points. There's something like 12,500 properties for sale across the country at the moment. Now it will be a bad time. You know, it's the end of the season for sellers and for agents. But, you know, it's an interesting market. I mean, in this year's listing of the top 10, there are several that were sold off market, including the property that gets the top billing, Ballantrae House in York and Cork.
This was extraordinary. And as you say, look, this is sort of dream win the lotto, win the Euro Millions territory, really, isn't it? Because
it completely is.
Yeah, maybe tell us a little bit about that property, the one in Cork. It's called the Ballantrae House Estate in York, I think it is.
That's it. And just to say, like, the figures here are for the properties and up to an acre of land, and according to what's on the property price register. Additional lands within big estates, such as this particular one, you know, are not registered on the property price register, just because sometimes it can be very confusing when you're looking at it and wondering, you know, you're reading different figures. But this has been sold off market. Mr. Dyson has bought it. A lot of us may have one of his vacuum cleaners in our homes, or indeed, you know, various hair devices. You know, a really interesting, innovative businessman who's owned a lot of property. And the property itself, this beautiful 11 bay property on the banks of the Blackwater River at a beautiful bend in the river, with various estate houses and, you know, an ancient abbey and all manner of lands as part of the sale. So, you know, he's a big landowner in the UK already. So it might be very interesting to see what he does with the estate.
It's an absolutely stunning property. I'd urge anyone who's interested in this type of thing just to go and look at that special supplement that was in the Irish Times. I think it was 2 weeks ago, maybe. But like, I mean, you just, it's the stuff that dreams are made of, isn't it? And he's such an interesting character as well. I think I read someplace that he had a big row in the UK about Brexit and stuff. Do you think that someone like him, like, why would Ireland be appealing to someone like?
Well, this is it. It is a gateway to Europe. I mean, that is absolutely, you know, it is tickling a lot of the grey matter in real estate circles at the moment. I mean, this is a property that has sold for 29.25 million.
Extraordinary. And is that an Irish record? That's starting it's certainly the record for 2024.
It's the record for 2024. Yes, it is the record for 2024. And I mean, it's a storied property, you know. Ryan O'Neill starred in a film there. You have glamour pusses from the like 80s and 90s. Princess TNT. Princess TNT was the moniker she was sort of given by the British glossy socialites. You know, those kind of magazines where they'd have pictures of a variety of people. She was photographed on the lawns there, and you know, seemingly, you know, the previous owner, you could kind of request permission to kind of walk through some of the lands. It seemed to be quite open. I don't know whether that's going to continue, but it is, you know, it is also part of our history, you know, whether we like it or not, you know, these estates. We have them all over the country.
And as you say, every single one of them that you've gone through have a fascinating backstory to them as well. Obviously, that's one in Cork, but in Dublin, some of the properties that sold and absolutely striking locations. One of them that I picked out was a one in Howth that was once owned by one of the Guinness socialites. I think it's called Centre House. That's beautiful. I mean, as well.
That's an incredible. I mean, you know, I'm a culture, you know, so I grew up in Achill and Donegal. So I'm always fascinated by the north side, south side kind of debate. And, you know, a lot of the properties in this, in our listings are south side based, you know. But this one, I always wonder why Howth isn't even bigger than it already is, given its proximity to the airport and so on. Do you know what I mean? If you're traveling internationally. But it's a magnificent, like, sort of 270-degree vistas facing south. But what's interesting about this, that this is a narrative going through at this level of the market. A lot of the buyers now, whereas maybe 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, they would be interested in taking on huge projects and refurbishing. And the appetite for that has gone because, you know, these people have money and know how to manage money, generally speaking, and are very money-minded. And they realize that there's very little value in refurbishment at the moment. So, they, you know, there is a significant core, particularly overseas market or the diaspora returning, who want turnkey condition. They don't want to have to engage the builders and all the rest, or especially if they're having to manage it from afar. And Centre House is one of those. That's what I'm getting to. So effectively, what the... the vendors did there was that they pretty much knocked everything except for the facade of the original house so that they could upgrade the fabric of the property to the levels that they wanted. So they have, so in addition to having a period form or a shell on the property, they have all the creature comforts, you know, underfloor heating, proper insulation, that are different forms of riches, you know. So, but the views from there and the access to the whole, the summit walk, you know, it is a very beguiling offer, and it's really wild. It's all gorse and you can smell the ozone. So you have this incredibly wild environment, but you're sheltered by granite rock to the rear, and you have, you know, the sea view looking south,
yeah,
like south facing orientation. You know, for 10 million, only 10
only
million.
10 million. It's a snip at 10 million,
yeah.
Alana.
Yeah.
Did you have a particular favourite from the list that struck you when you were going through it?
I loved Centre. I mean, I love the sea. So, you know, that would be one of mine. I also love a period property. Like, then again, you know, we're back to sort of off-market deals. The Italian embassy buying the 21 Temple Road, the former childhood home of Garrett Fitzgerald.
Oh, Lonsdale. Yeah, that's beautiful, yeah.
Yeah, that was 7.5 million. Beautiful Italianate kind of intricacies in it. So it's nice to see that the Italian embassy has gotten it. You know, and then very contemporary kind of, you know, demand as well. Like, you've got Lansdowne Place, the Templeton, the big
that K Club,
penthouse
the
there.
K Club thing was a big price as well. The Churchfields, I think it was called.
Price, Churchfields, yeah, 6 million. And again, off market. And this is, you know, this is an audience. This is a tiny micro slice of the market. Really values its privacy.
And that's a point I wanted to bring up with you, Alana. Like, has Ireland in general always been a sort of attractive place for people who want to stay out of the public eye? I recall many years ago when the Kardashians came here for some honeymoon or something, and a big part of it was nobody was following them around. Irish people kind of like to sniff at celebrities and say, we're not really that bothered. Is that a big attraction for Ireland, for these people who are trying to stay out of the public eye?
Well, you see, this is the thing. The buyers now often at times are out of the public eye. You know, there's kind of trends in buying as well as everything else. So, like, you know, back in the 80s, you would have had people like, you know, the rock stars and all of the various tax breaks given to artists at every level of the market. So you had all sorts of rock stars living here and buying big piles. And a lot of the medical profession were buying the big properties. Then that changed, and you had the Legal Eagle sort of in the 90s. And that then moved on to the IT sector, that first kind of wave of the dot-com boom in the early 2000s. Then you had the big developers coming in. And then post-crash, you know, a lot of them are quite quiet buyers. You know, some of them have been very lucky. They would have had businesses, they sold them, or they had significant shares in tech. And they're buying very quietly.
Yes.
And that is of value to them.
And that's a very interesting point. I actually bumped into one of those techie people who was, he was one of the figures in that movie, The Big Short, a couple of years ago, a more boring person you couldn't meet in your whole life. And he bought a big pile here in Ireland, and he said he just wanted a quiet life where nobody would recognise him. But I think he could have got that quiet life anywhere in the world, to be honest with you, because nobody would recognise him. Alana, did Donald Trump coming back now in January 2025, a lot of American high flyers thinking of fleeing America for Europe. Do you think that that's something we should look out for? Maybe more people looking to these big homes here in Ireland?
Well, look, we just don't know. We'll just have to wait and see and watch and read the Irish Times. And, but the figures are enormous. You know, like over 1,200 homes over the price of over 2 million.
There was 62 homes in excess of 3 million. And as I say, when you get into those figures of 10 million, 29 million, it's just another world.
It really, really is. For us, it's the looking, and it's for journalists like Jessica and myself. It's, you know, it is a privilege to be able to get in and look at some of these properties and see them up close and, you know, see the workmanship in them and wonder at who the buyers might be. Because, yeah, you know, the buyers are equally fussy. Like, you know, even with all of the money that they have, they would have, you know, they would say that, you know, they want turnkey and they find it difficult to buy. And some of the properties, another trend is kind of some of the properties might be brought off market to market first, and then they go on the market, you know. So it's an intricate dance done by very skilled estate agents.
It certainly is, yeah. And a very lucrative one for them, I'd imagine. Alana, listen, it's a fascinating walk through those prestigious homes. And thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today. We really appreciate it. That was Alana Gallagher of the Irish Times. Thank you. You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. After the break, we look at the red lines flashing on the world's economy with Tom Stanage from The Economist. Don't go anywhere. You welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, for our final item today, we're going to look ahead to 2025. The world is grappling with seismic shifts across politics, economy and technology. And the return of Donald Trump to the White House looks certain to bring sweeping changes to global diplomacy. And that continued rivalry between the US and China is manifesting itself, it seems, in tariff and trade wars that lie ahead of us. Joining me to delve into these matters and more is Tom Standage, who is the deputy editor at The Economist magazine. Tom, you're very welcome to News Talk.
Hello, it's good to be here.
Now, Tom, look, we've just had an election here in Ireland, and one of the key things that all of the parties who were involved in the campaign were warning about was the return of Donald Trump to the White House in 2025. We are a small, open economy on the edge of Europe, and as you know, we depend heavily on multinationals. They contribute a lot to our corporation tax and employ a great deal of people here in Ireland. But is Trump a cause for major instability and concern in a more global sense?
Yes, he is. I mean, the worrying thing is we just don't know what he's going to do. He's said he's going to do things like increase tariffs on imports from China, but also from everyone else, including America's allies. He has various policies that we're not clear where he stands on America's alliances. How solidly is he behind allies in Europe and Asia? We just can't tell. And so there's this enormous economic and also political uncertainty about what he's going to do. Domestically, he has a bunch of policies. You know, he wants to slash the government. He wants to deport millions of people and so on. Those also have international implications. But I think it's specifically on the trade side of things and also on the American alliances and foreign policy that there is, frankly, enormous global uncertainty as a result of his election.
Mm. And you've been writing about this recently. When you're looking ahead to 2025, you've identified 10 things that we should start looking out for. And as you said there, one of those, and you very eloquently refer to it as terrifying prospects, those tariffs that he's warning about, like how substantial could they be and what effect could they have on global trade?
Well, we should remember there are tariffs in place now. Donald Trump introduced tariffs on quite a few goods from quite a lot of different countries during his first term. And Joe Biden got rid of some of them, but actually extended some others. But they're quite targeted. They're on specific goods from specific places. And what he's talking about now is something quite different, which is blanket tariffs, where absolutely everything from a given country has a tariff applied to it. And so he's talking about 60% on goods from China and 10 to 20% on goods from other countries. And 25% he's talked about on goods from Mexico and Canada. And they are very big exporters to the US. About 80% of their exports go to the US. So this would be absolutely devastating for the economies of Mexico and Canada. Big American car makers make quite a lot of their popular models in those countries. And so, you know, increasing the price of a car by 25% would obviously have a big effect on sales. This would also affect the American economy as well, because it would increase the cost of inputs to American companies, and it would drive up inflation, because we should remember that tariffs are not paid by the exporting country, as Donald Trump seems to think. They're paid by the importing country. They're paid by mostly the consumers, in fact, in that country. So this is, in effect, a massive sales tax on American consumers. And so that would lead to inflation because it would lead to higher prices for them as well. So this would really have a massive impact on exporting countries, and it would also have a big impact on America. And last time America tried sweeping tariffs on this scale was the Smoot-Hawley tariffs of 1930. And the result of that was that global trade fell by two-thirds. So that's now, you know, Smoot-Hawley is now a byword for disastrous economic policymaking. So I think the big question is, does Donald Trump mean it? And is this just some sort of negotiating ploy? There's some evidence that it is, but he may impose sort of some level of tariffs, a small level, in order to try and get concessions out of some countries. The other thing we should remember from his first term is that he's extremely transactional about this. So if there's a country or a company that's nice to him, then he will let them off. And we saw this last time around. So there's going to be a huge amount of lobbying to get close to him to try and get special deals and special exemptions. That's the way Donald Trump likes to do things.
It was very interesting last weekend to see his interactions with President Macron, who was definitely in the front row in every sense, trying to kind of cozy up to Donald Trump ahead of his impending return. You mentioned there, Tom, inflation. We saw another rate reduction in the EU this week, and the world's central bankers have been celebrating the defeat of inflation. But what happens after they've got inflation under control like this? What are the next challenges to try and deal with that success, if you like?
Well, I think the big firstly, there's a concern that that the tariffs that Donald Trump wants to impose could actually reignite inflation, because if other countries, other parts of the world impose retaliatory tariffs, then that raises the prices of goods coming into those regions as well, and that could lead to inflation. So actually, the declaration that we have defeated inflation may turn out to be premature. But I think focus has definitely been switching from that as the main economic challenge that advanced economies face, to dealing with deficits. And we have many countries that are living beyond their means because essentially they raised spending during the pandemic and have not ratcheted it back down again. And so the US is running a 6% GDP deficit, which is, it's spending more on debt servicing than it is on the military, which is really saying something for America, with the world's biggest military spender. But other countries like France and Italy, spring to mind, have unsustainable deficits. The French government has collapsed because basically they can't decide on what they should cut to deal with this. We are looking at basically austerity in many countries in 2025. We haven't heard about this in 2024 because we've had elections all over the world, more elections than ever before in human history. In fact, more people voting, affecting more than half of the world's population in total. First time that's ever happened. And the trouble is, if you talk about austerity in elections, then it's not a really good way to win votes. You win votes by promising people goodies.
So we
have some really difficult choices looming in 2025 in many countries. The other thing that makes this worse is that you've got this economic uncertainty because of Trump, and you've also got the fact that many European countries are going to want to raise their defence spending because they're not sure that they can rely on the US as an ally anymore. And so that makes things even more difficult. And so, yeah, it's going to be very, very tough, and we're going to have some really, really difficult and unpopular choices coming in 2025.
Yeah, and that's another thing that you point out about the aftermath of all those elections in 2024, of course, is that voters expect change. You mentioned France there. We've also discussed on this programme Germany quite recently. Both big powerhouses in the European Union now in a state of flux. So what does that mean, voters expect change? And what's your analysis of what might happen with those new governments who have promised a lot and may not still be able to deliver?
No, exactly. So we've had all of these elections this year, and the sort of takeaway from them is that voters have asked for change, and that incumbent parties have done badly. They've either lost altogether, or they've been forced into coalition or cohabitation, or they've ended up as minority governments. And we've seen this across the board. In fact, we've seen it in Ireland as well. So essentially, people are not voting for or against particular orientation, you know, left-wing or right-wing parties. It's not about a shift towards or away from nationalism or populism or greenery or anything like that. It's just been across the board, we don't want what we have now, or we want to sort of take them down a peg or two. And that means that in 2025, the newly elected governments in places like Britain and America are going to be expected to deliver on the promises that they've made. And no one has made more promises than Donald Trump. And those governments that have been chastened by not doing as well as they expected, but have just about clung on, are going to be, you know, the question I think will be, will they change their ways? Will voters say, look, you know, we made our views clear that we weren't entirely happy with what you were doing. What are you going to do about it?
Mm.
And I think that's really the big question. People are expecting change. And if they don't get the degree of change they want, then, you know, we could be looking at, you know, dissatisfaction, unrest in some countries. I mean, and other places to keep an eye on, South Africa, for example, where the ANC has gone into coalition for the first time with the Democratic Alliance. Will that unlikely coalition hold together? We'll see. So these are the sorts of things, if you look around the world, that we can expect in 2025.
Mm. We actually managed to book the trend here in Ireland, and I think we were one of the outliers. It could have something to do with our economy doing very well, but, you know, a large two-thirds of the last government was returned to office. But I think it also could come down to the fact that the election was a lot to do with promising a lot in 2025 and beyond. So maybe that's a lot to do with why we booked the trend. It's not all doom and gloom, though. I mean, there are possibilities that we can look to for advancement in the economic sense, at least, around clean technologies and AI. You think that around those AI issues, this could be a big year?
Yes, I think it's potentially a crunch year for AI because so much money's going into it. But actually, if you look, not many companies are really using it.
Or say they're using it.
Well, exactly. There is this disparity between adoption and investment. That said, if you look at polls of people rather than companies, a lot of employees say they're using it. So it's about a third of employees overall in America. It's up to about 80% of software programmers, 75% of people who work in HR departments. So that suggests there's a lot of people using AI at work and they're just not telling the boss.
Mm.
And that suggests that there is a big sort of cultural barrier to getting adoption of AI sort of officially to happen in companies. And so I think that tells you that AI adoption is as much a cultural and management problem as it is a technological problem.
Yeah.
So I think the big question for 2025 is, can AI be made sort of more useful and more palatable to companies before investors lose their nerve? So that's the sort of thing to watch out for. On the clean tech side, we are seeing a really extraordinary boom in clean tech because China's economy is in a mess. And so they've turned to exports of low-cost clean tech, solar panels, EVs, batteries, that kind of stuff, and as a way to sort of, you know, drive growth, so export-led growth. That has led to tariffs being introduced in many parts of the world where car makers, for example, are worried about the impact of very, very good, cheap Chinese EVs on their own sales. But I think overall for the world, it's very good because it means that lots of parts of the world, developing countries in particular, can load up on renewable technology very, very cheaply.
Mm.
And so overall, I think it's a net positive. The other thing is that China itself is adopting this technology very fast. It's got twice as much solar and wind capacity under construction as the rest of the world put together, which is extraordinary.
Extraordinary. And you can already see how it's affecting economies like Germany in the manufacturing sense. You know, that's something they've been dealing with for the last number of years. So, yeah, that's certainly something to look out for. Travel troubles then is the last thing I wanted to ask you about. You talk about the global movement of people. There's a lot of unrest in the world. So how do you think those border issues might manifest themselves or be a cause for concern in 2025?
Well, the travel troubles I'm referring to there are to do with the legal movement of people rather than, illegal migration and refugees and those sorts of problems. So I'm really talking about tourism and business travel.
Okay.
Where you are seeing, you know, aviation is becoming more difficult because airlines are trying to avoid flying over war zones, over conflict zones, even over hostile countries. So it takes 2 hours longer now to get from New York to Delhi than it used to because American airlines do not want to fly over Russia. Indian airlines don't mind flying over Russia, so they can get there 2 hours quicker. So it's those sorts of things. And then the Schengen agreement, being extended in some ways, but also internal borders sort of reappearing within it as well. The EU is introducing its ESTA-like system, and Britain is going to introduce something similar next year as well. So that means that sort of more applying for permits to go to other parts of the world. And we're also seeing restrictions on short-term rentals like Airbnb in some cities, Amsterdam, New York, and so on, and protests against over-tourism,
yes,
particularly in Spain. So I think there is sort of concern that, you know, it's getting harder. There's more friction. There's more points of friction for travel. And I think a lot of this comes down with the sort of concern about over tourism to the very, very rapid rebound of tourism that we saw after the pandemic. It's had to grow by 50% a year in the last 3 years to get back to its pre-pandemic level, which it now has. But that's a lot faster growth than the 5% a year growth in international arrivals that we saw before that. I think we should go back to the sort of rate of tourism growth into 2025 that we saw before the pandemic. So that 50% growth was very much an anomaly, and it was just catch-up growth. And I hope that will mean that the sort of anti-tourist backlash dies down a bit. But those restrictions on short-term rentals and things, and you know, capping the number of visitors to Pompeii, charging people entering Venice fees and this sort of thing, that's all going to stay in place.
Okay. Well, that's certainly something we've covered a lot on this programme, and we look out for it again in 2025. Tom, before I let you go, in my deep dive research into you, I discovered that you had published a book, and it's on the New York bestseller list. And we happen to be doing a special programme next week for people who tune into this show. It's a global geopolitical show, and we always do every Christmas a special programme about books. So maybe just tell us a bit about yours, because it's very intriguing.
Which books do you mean?
It's The World in Six Glasses, the one...
So I wrote A History of the World in Six Glasses, which, as its name suggests, is a history of the whole world told through drink. So beer in the Bronze Age, wine in Greece and Rome, spirits in the Age of Exploration, coffee in the Enlightenment, tea in imperialism, Coca-Cola and the rise of America, and consumerism. So, yeah, you get to sort of drink your way through history, and it continues. It's actually been out nearly 20 years now.
I thought it was a relatively new book.
It continues to sell as well as it does.
Well, yes, that's good. And what better stocking filler for Christmas?
Indeed. Absolutely. Cheers to that.
Tom, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you today. Thank you very much for taking the time to be with us. That was Tom Standage, the Deputy Editor of The Economist. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. Just a reminder that while we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're always available as a podcast first from Friday mornings on the News Talk app. Thanks to all of today's guests for their very valuable time and insights. The producer of Taking Stock was John Fardy. Simon Keane was on research, and Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. If you have any comments on any of today's items, you can get in touch with us by emailing takingstock@newstalk.com. Anton is coming up next with all of your Sunday newspapers and lots, lots more. But for now, from Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, thank you for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC.
On News Talk.